This is Paul Segrist. We are now beginning the continuation of our interview with David Froelich, who came from Germany in 1939 when he was 11, and we have now relocated to his terrace outside his daughter's apartment. So continue. We are now in Holland.
Okay, we're now in Nijmegen, which is the terminus of the train ride from Germany. It is Sunday afternoon, October 1st, about 5 p.m., and we still have to face the Dutch authorities. I must explain, the Dutch had a strict rule of allowing only transients to enter Holland. They did not accept anyone else. Now, the trick was for us to get across the barrier. There were two gentlemen, two guards, one a younger fellow who was a spokesman, and an older man about 50. On the other side of the barrier was my father's cousin and a stranger who was an agent of the highest organization, whose function was to see that we get across into Holland illegally. The spokesman asked for the ship's passage, the ticket, which was a fake passage, and he was a clever fellow, and he says, "I'm sorry, this boat has left already, you cannot come in." Obviously, all of our hearts sank. Here we are, stranded. At this precise second, the agent went into operation. He approached the older man. He whispered something into his ear, and they shook hands. And I saw that in the hand was money. He bribed him. And the older man nudged the younger man and says, "Hey, Carl, you're mistaken." And he showed him his hand with the money in it. "That boat was delayed. It's leaving tomorrow." And the younger man sees the money, and he says, "Ach ja, Carl." And he says to my father, my mother, "I'm sorry, forgive me." And he opens the portal doors, and that's how we got into Holland. We went to another part of the railroad station, and we went on a train. We went into Amsterdam. This was still the festival of Booth, which is a fall holiday for Jewish people. Now, we haven't had any meat in 5 years because we keep kosher, and there was no kosher meat available in Nazi Germany. Furthermore, we had to have ration. Jews had less ration than non-Jews, but ration was for everybody in Germany. So our stomachs had shrunken, and we were barely subsisting on basics. In fact, my sister Ruth had developed rickets because she was a baby, and she didn't get the proper vitamins. We went to a restaurant, a kosher restaurant in Amsterdam, and we sat in one of the booths, the sukkah, S-U-C-C-A-H, the sukkah, which we were supposed to, by tradition, eat during that week. And they gave us, of all things, roast duck, which is about the greasiest and fattest. Now, obviously, the next day, all of us got sicker than a dog. The next day, Monday, my father went to the government, the authorities, and told them the truth. "Here I am here illegally. I have no intention of staying. I have a visa to come to the United States. I ask of you only one thing, to give me a transit visa for 30 days. Tomorrow I'll get me a ship's passage on the liner. I'll be out of here." The official said, "Mr. Froelich, know ye, your request will be granted for 30 days. But after 30 days, and if you're still in Holland, you're going to be shipped back to Germany." My father came home singing and dancing. We have 30 days grace. The next day he went down to the agents. There was one street where all the agents are located. What he didn't realize was that everybody, every Tom, Dick, and Harry had the same idea. There were literally hundreds and hundreds of people who were wanting to get out of Europe before the Nazis marched into the Low Countries. Well, 1 week went by, nothing. We have 3 weeks. 2 weeks went by, still no passage.
Where were you staying during
that
time?
All right, my mother, my father, my sisters were in a rooming house, which was paid for by the cousin. The cousin took me into his home. He had a little baby girl, who was about 2 years of age, and they were living in a very fancy section, almost like a suburb of Amsterdam. And I walked every day, it was about 2 kilometers, from where I was staying to be with my parents all day long. 2 weeks, nothing. The third week, still nothing. Now we're really beginning to worry. We have 7 days left. Well, in Jewish tradition, Tuesday is supposed to be a better day because in the Bible, when God, the creation story, God on the third day didn't say, and it was good, it says very good. And on Tuesday, my father came home, he says, I got good news and I got bad news. So what's the good news? I got passage on a Dutch liner that's leaving from Antwerp. What's the bad news? We have to travel on the Sabbath, which normally we don't do. But the first law of Judaism is to save life. And to preserve life, you can violate any and all rules. My father pleaded with the authorities, please don't move until sundown. This is winter time. Sundown is over at Sabbath is over by 4:35 o'clock. No. The procedure is very rigid. You have to report to the port in Rotterdam at 9 o'clock Saturday morning. There will be a sealed train leaving with all passengers on board because we have experienced that many times people will jump off the train while it's in motion and hide somewhere and stay illegally. To avoid that, we have guards on the train. Well, if you have to, you have to. We said goodbye to my father's cousin in Amsterdam Friday. We took a train to Rotterdam Friday afternoon. We checked into a hotel near the port. And Saturday morning, we took a taxi, went to the port. We sat there, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, 12 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 4:15, about 15 or 20 minutes before sundown. They called us. We got on the train. Sure enough, it was guarded. Every door had a guard there. And we rumbled along, jam-packed, all Jews, I suppose, all going to the same boat. The name of the boat was Veendam, capital V-E-E-D-A-M. I guess that's it, Veendam, on the Dutch-American line. Now, it was one of the smaller boats, but for me, an impressionable 11 years, it was a huge boat. My father saw the crush of humanity, because there were not only the 750 passengers, but about 5,000 people who tried to get on illegally. Because everybody smelled this was the last boat. It was literally the last boat that we took. My father said to my mother and to us, let's make a human chain, otherwise we're going to get separated. So he told me to lead, and I had my sister Lottie on one hand, who was 4 years of age, and my mother was holding her hand, and my father brought up the rear, having my sister Ruth in his arms, and a suitcase. Somewhere along that, there was a suitcase. Somebody had a suitcase. I think I had a suitcase. At any rate, I went to the gangplank, and they were saying to me, not verbally, but with sign language, going up. And I saw only the cranes. I've never seen a crane in my life before, and the hole being loaded and so on. So I went up, and I let go of my sister, and this huge crush of humanity. Now, in those days, I spoke just German, nothing else. I knew our cabin number. And I got so impressed by what I saw, I forgot about my family. I thought they were right next to me. Next thing I turn around, no mother, no father, no anybody. I wasn't frightened. I wasn't upset. I said to myself, when the boat gets going, I'll go to the captain. He'll know how to, get me back to the family. But my mother, obviously, was hysterical. She was very, very worried. She didn't know whether I was on the boat or off the boat. I walked around and I started asking people for the cabin number. And people answered me in every language under the rainbow, but German. Well, in my course of wandering around, I literally bumped into my mother. And she was so happy to see me, she hugged and kissed me. Now, many years later, being a father and a grandfather, if this would have happened, I don't know, it's hard to say, but she really should have beat the living daylights out of me because I was wrong. I mean, I shouldn't have let go. My father, in the meantime, had a very unpleasant experience. There were stowaways in our cabin. There were Jews, and they refused to budge. It was them or us. So he went to the captain or the purser or some authority and they had to be forcibly removed. My father cried, but there was nothing we could do. We finally left port, Antwerp, at about 11 o'clock Saturday night, and we went to our cabin, and the next thing I know, in the morning, we were leaning left and right. I got up, I went on deck, people were vomiting and were seasick all over the place, and I got hypnotized by the water. This is the first experience, this business up and down, and that's the worst thing that can happen. So my father was thinking he was doing me a favor. He says, let's go into the galley. I'll get you a cup of tea. Well, liquids is the worst thing you can do. So obviously I began to get sick myself. I was better off than most. I was seasick for a day or two. My mother was in bed throughout the whole journey. We got into the channel, and there were a lot of boats. We were supposed to go to Southampton to pick up more passengers, but there were mines all over the place. The German U-boats were after us. They did not honor the Geneva Convention of Neutrality. And so the captain SOS for a British destroyer escort. When the Germans saw the British coming, then they let us go. They blew up a merchant vessel about a half a mile away from us, and we were given SOS signals to pick up survivors. We couldn't pick anybody up. So we just anchored right there, had a launch come from Southampton with the people, and they went on board. And the destroyer escort guided us into the Atlantic Ocean. When we got into the ocean, then we had a new problem. The weather was bad. The Atlantic is notoriously known to be very stormy in October, November. So the captain told us it's going to change course. We're not going to America. We're going to Halifax, Nova Scotia. We were changing course for a day or two, and then we ran into icebergs, and we had to change back again. And we got into severe storms. We were quartered. Our meals were given to us in our cabin. Two crew members were washed overboard. It was a horrible ride. Two people died of natural causes. We're supposed to be on the ocean 7 days. We were on the ocean 13. On November 10, at 6 a.m. in the morning, we finally made it into New York Harbor. I remember very vividly the impression, a very, very elated sort of thing. I was choked up with emotion, even though I was only 11. I saw all these skyscrapers lit up. It was dark. It was wintertime. Little jewels, little twinkles, and the Statue of Liberty were within, I don't know, 100 feet, Statue of Liberty, heading for Ellis Island. And
was your mother feeling better by
then? Yeah, by that time she was feeling better. My father was very nervous, and the immigration authorities came on board at Ellis Island. They were very not nice. They were all Irishmen in those days. They were anesthetized, you know, so many people, and they were very not nice. They spoke only English.
What did they do? What did the immigration officials do when they were on the boat?
Well, they checked visas on the boat. They checked visas primarily and documentation on the boat. Otherwise, they wouldn't let you, you know. And they turned you over to a health inspector. They used to quarantine people. Although I know of no one of our boat who was quarantined. They may have, I don't know. I do recall that a lot of photographers came on board, and there was a pretty girl, young girl in her 20s. Cheesecake pictures, you know. Even though in those days skirts were long, she had skirts up to here. Very dark complected, long black hair, and taking pictures. Years later, I discovered who it was. It was Hedy Lamarr. I remember also that it was Friday, and we were petrified. My father was so nervous, they called people in alphabetical order. My father didn't hear his name called.
This is on the boat.
On the boat. So they said, we have to wait to the end. Now, the boat was due to go to Boston to refuel and pick up food and go back to Holland. And we were afraid that we were going to be stuck on the boat, and we wouldn't want to get off on Friday afternoon later than a certain time because of the Sabbath. Well, my father had an uncle who had a brother-in-law who was an American who had a famous fish restaurant at Times Square. And he came on board at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And he talked to the authority. I don't think he bribed him. He just explained. And he had a reputation. I mean, he was like Toots Shore, that kind of thing. He had a fish restaurant. I saw the restaurant. It was a fancy restaurant. At least it was fancy to me. And he got us off immediately. And not only that, there were a lot of people we befriended who got off the boat and went in those cubby holes in alphabetical order, pens-like. And that's where you get your luggage and you get final clearance. And we had no problem at all. I mean, we were off, once we got off the boat, we were in Ellis Island no more than 10, 15 minutes, which I was told later on was very unusual.
What do you think your parents are thinking, your father specifically, what do you think he's thinking through all of this?
That's very difficult to answer. I really don't know. My father obviously was very concerned. He was always a provider. He was very concerned about what the future has in store for him, especially for a man who never had to work for anybody else in his life. He was a boss all of his life. Not only was he a boss, he was a millionaire. And now he has to start from scratch. He was 45 years of age. He had three little kids. He had really no trade. He didn't know the language. He didn't know how to drive a car. He had no money. He was destitute. He lost everything. So what I would imagine, I'm second guessing, is what's going to happen to us? How are we going to manage? What's going to be? Now, we knew we were not going to stay in New York. This was already decided before. My mother had a married brother and two married sisters who had left Germany before us and relocated in St. Louis, Missouri. Now, immediately, we were taken from Ellis Island by limousine, which I'm sure that happened to everybody that got off Ellis Island, to my uncle's house. He had a rented apartment in Washington Heights in Manhattan. We stayed there for a week. My father also had another relative who lived in Brooklyn, who was very well off, who had his own meatpacking plant. And there was, until I left America, there still may be today, although this relative is long deceased, but he had a son who may have taken over, I don't know, Frolic Meat Market. He had a small packing house on Hanson Street in Brooklyn. Well, he slaughtered and sold a lot of the meat. No, the other way around. It was slaughtered in East St. Louis, Illinois, by Hunter Packing, and was bought by my father's relative. And the relative wrote a letter to Hunter saying, I will buy X number of sides in addition to what I normally buy if you get my cousin a job in the meat packing plant. And that's what happened. My father got a job initially at Hunter Packing in East St. Louis. My father was working from the first day. We never had any problems. My father got the job was a very low stationed position. He was a helper in the kosher department. Kosher meat had to be put a seal into it, verifying that it's kosher. And it's a very menial task. I mean, you just take a seal and put it into the meat. He got $10 a week, but he made a living of that. In 39, you could do that.
I want to ask you a question. As a little boy in Germany, before you got here, what did you know of America? What did you expect of America?
Good question.
You're there.
Yes, yes, yes. I knew about one thing. America is full of Indians. America is a wild country. Cowboys and Indians. In fact, on my 10th birthday in Germany, from my uncle and aunt living in America, I got a cowboy suit. And I also remember that my first motion picture in America was Drums Along the Mohawk, which scared the living daylights out of me.
Because it represented the America that you were.
Right. I did not think of civilized life here. I thought it would be like it was in 1492.
So what was it like being a little German boy in the middle of New York?
Well, New York was like paradise. I wasn't here very long. I was here a week. I do remember a subway ride, which was alien and strange to me. I do remember seeing 42nd Street and all the neon signs and all the hub and so on, but I didn't like it. For that matter, I didn't like St. Louis when I first came either. And I was crying, I want to go back. Nazis and all.
Now, you said before that in Germany, your parents had taken English lessons.
Yeah, some rudimentary English lessons. First of all, it was English, not American English. Second of all, they only learned yes and no and hello and not enough to really speak.
So you were in New York a week?
A week.
And then you went to?
The Hyatts gave us a railroad ticket on the, in those days, New York Central, to go the long way. It took a two-day journey to St. Louis by train. It was also horrible.
Talk about that trip.
Okay. We went to Grand Central and took a train to Buffalo. That was a good train. It was an express train, but it was an all-day affair. It took about 10 hours. And we had to go from one railroad station to another. Now, we had American money. It was given to us by Hyatts to tidy us over on the train ride. But we didn't know one coin from another, and we didn't know how to speak. My father and I went to the heart of town looking for a kosher deli or a place where we can get some kosher food and something to drink. And we spotted a kosher butcher shop that had the word kosher, kasher, in Hebrew. And the guy spoke Yiddish, which is near to German. And when he heard that we were refugees, he gave us a lot of food free of, he wouldn't take any money. But he didn't have any drinks. So we went back to the railroad station. Now, the other thing about the railroad station is, the railroad station had a symbolical stuffed buffalo, life size. My middle sister Lottie saw that buffalo and she went hysterical. And we had to move away from the center of the station because of that. What we didn't know is that my sisters had contracted measles on the boat, and they began to break out on the train. And they were getting sick with fever on the train. Oh, we were looking for some liquid, and we didn't know any words. We just pointed, and we got something entirely different that we wanted. And we gave them a coin. We didn't know it was the right coin or the wrong coin. They gave us some coin back, but it had no significance whatsoever. But somehow we managed. We went from Buffalo. The train left about 8 o'clock at night. Went all night long to Cleveland, and from Cleveland, this is really going the long way. I mean, the Pennsylvania Railroad would have been much quicker going from here to Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, Indianapolis, St. Louis, but we went the long way. From Cleveland all the way through Ohio, Indiana, and then down to southern Illinois, to Cairo, Illinois, and finally up to St. Louis. We got to St. Louis on a Friday again at 3, and we were met by my mother's brother and sisters. And they took us to a rented apartment, furnished, a two-room place. And my aunt went to the store and bought some food. And we were very lonesome and miserable. But my father got a job, and I was taken to school. And gradually, we acclimated, slowly.
Did your mother get a job?
No, my mother never worked. My father was the only provider. My father got raises then and got different jobs. And I went to elementary school, and gradually I learned English. Relatively speaking, I learned it rather quickly. My sister certainly did.
Talk a little bit about being, you know, a German child in the Midwest, and what school was like
for
you. All
right, the Jewish children were very kind to me. There were several Jewish children who spoke Yiddish, and with them I was able to communicate.
Was there a large Jewish community in this town?
St. Louis had 60,000 Jews. St. Louis in those days was one of the top 10 cities in America. I think it ranked 6th or 7th in the nation. We had 750,000 people in St. Louis, which is about double what it has today. And it was a white town, not a black town like it is today. And the Jewish community was still living in the city proper. Today, there are many Jews in St. Louis, but there isn't a single Jew in St. Louis City. Just like there isn't any white people in St. Louis City. They all live in St. Louis County, which is the suburbs. St. Louis is an oddity. It is the only city in America with no county. Washington also is like that, but every other city has a county. St. Louis County is not St. Louis City. It's separate. And University City and Clayton and Ladue and Webster Grove and Ferguson and 50 other suburbs are St. Louis County. And St. Louis County has about 1.5 million people today.
So there were other Jewish children in school?
Many, many. I went to a very lousy elementary school in a poor section of St. Louis.
What grade did they start you off in?
Fifth. I repeated the fifth grade because they felt that's where I belong. The regular teacher was not there. She was recovering from an automobile accident. We had a sub teacher. She just left me alone. She didn't do much of anything. And when the regular teacher came back, who was a very strong disciplinarian, but a very kind woman who befriended me like my teacher in Germany. She was very rough on me in some ways. She demanded a great deal, and it did me a lot of good. Miss Farrell, may she rest in peace, and I became friends in adulthood. She and I met when I became a teacher myself. We had many reminiscences. She never married because in those days, by law, it was forbidden for married women to be teachers. Only single women were allowed to be teachers.
How did you learn English?
She helped me a lot, Miss Farrell.
How did she help you?
By demanding that I pay attention, by repeating over and over. She gave me a lot of private lessons after school, spent an awful lot of time with me individually on a one-to-one. She used to make an example of me. This was good for her vis-a-vis the other kids, that if I didn't respond because I didn't understand, she would grab me by the ear and drag me to the blackboard. She was also instrumental in my becoming a history buff because she was basically a major in history.
Did you experience any anti-Semitic behavior in
none.
This time? Again, because of the
none.
Jewish population?
None. This was an integrated Jewish, non-Jewish, not black, white. There were no blacks. I had no contact with blacks for many, many years thereafter.
What, was it almost odd to you that there was no anti-Semitic
no.
attitude?
No, it was not odd. No, because I did not.
You grew up in an environment.
Yeah,
like
but I didn't experience it in Holland, and I didn't see any anti-Semitism in New York. And I recognized already then that I was in a free country.
Talk a little bit about your mother in St. Louis.
My mother was a homemaker. And she was.
Did she adapt to America easily?
She adapted to America. What she didn't adapt to is having to do all the work herself, because we had maids and butlers in Germany. And now she had to do it all herself. We had a series of illnesses. I was the one who came down with a middle ear infection. And I was very sick for about 2 weeks. Oh, after a month we were in America. My mother became very ill. She had a goiter, an external goiter. And in those days they didn't treat it the way they do now. Eventually she had surgery. And it was 50-50, it was very tough. It was in 44. By that time I was really a teenager, and I dropped out of school, took care of my sisters. My father had a job in World War II. He transferred from one department to another department in order to make more money. And he was in the cooler in the beef boning department, and his blood froze on him. And he got diphtheria, and he was very sick, and he was in isolation hospital. We had some very rough sledding. My father had to work from scratch. I mean, he was a fellow who worked with his head all the time, and now he had to work with his hands. My father worked for others for 9 years, till age 48. Then he went in business for himself again.
And did your parents keep in contact with their relatives that they left behind?
Only until Pearl Harbor. Then it was impossible. Once America got in the war, we were cut off. Yes, and in fact, I have a letter in my possession of my father's sister who had wanted to come to America, but somehow we couldn't raise the necessary money to get a visa. And the American consulate in Hamburg was not as nice and as generous as the one in Stuttgart. And they didn't get it, and they perished. And this is the only family that there were no survivors. Even those uncles and aunts who did not come out had children who came out ahead. That's another thing. My mother was the instrument here. My father was very keen on my leaving ahead of the family in what was called a children's transport. And the one that I was supposed to go on perished. My mother says we're going to survive, we're going to die together or live together. And she was dead right. Now I have one friend who now lives in Atlanta who was in a children's transport. And he survived because he was taken to France. And nuns were able to hide him and some others. But he was cut off from his family throughout the whole war. And he didn't get liberated until 1945. His family got out in 40 and came to America. But between 40 and 45, his mother and father and sister were in the States, and he was in France. And they didn't know whether he was living or dead. But in most cases, the children, transport children, did not survive, and they perished. Now, the only thing that perished, as far as we were concerned, was our lift. The lift was confiscated by the Germans once they marched into Rotterdam.
The lift, you're talking about your possessions?
Our possessions, yeah. That was down the drain.
So you had just your suitcase.
That's right. What happened was that people who were Polish Jews and Russian Jews who had come to St. Louis in the 20s and 30s and had made it, you know, established themselves. One donated a chair, one a bed, a table, a dresser. That was our first furniture until my father was able to have enough money to buy his own stuff. We lived in the rented furnished apartment 6 months. Then we went into an unfurnished apartment, which we lived for 10 years. And by that time, my father was in business for himself. And
you were on your feet.
Yeah.
Strongly. In our final few minutes.
All right. The other thing is that my mother and my father both learned English sufficient to be considered fluent, to be able to write it and read it and speak it. My mother learned how to type on an English typewriter and was able to type letters. My father had to know English in order to use it on his work. Ironically, when they retired and emigrated to Israel, over the years, they lost it. My mother, of course, can't speak at all today. She's completely vegetable. But my father communicates with us today in German. Now, with my wife, he still communicates in English. But his English has deteriorated greatly.
Did your parents ever want to go back to Germany for any reason?
No.
Maybe not to move, but even
No. In fact, my father had the opportunity, as I had the opportunity, to go visit. He refused. You know, what my father once had wanted to do was to come back to America, but there was no chance for doing that.
I see.
He had very good years early on in Israel, but as he got older, things got worse for him, and he's wishful thinking and dreaming of how he doesn't realize that things have changed in America drastically. There are dichotomies in my own mind. Financially, of course, had I stayed, I would be much better off than I am today.
Had you stayed in Germany?
No. I'm talking about, not talking about Germany. I have never wanted to be in Germany, wanted to go back. I have gone back to Germany. I go up to Germany a lot to visit.
I'm sorry, had you stayed in the U.S.?
Yes, had I stayed in New York or in St. Louis. Had I stayed in St. Louis, I would have easily become a high school principal within a short 5 or 6 years. Had I stayed in New York, because of my political affiliation, I would be a member of Congress today. There's no doubt about that. As it is, I am a publicly elected official. I've been the chairman of Democrats Abroad in Israel. The Democratic Party and the Republican Party have branches in foreign countries, and they're in a Democratic Party are treated like states, and a country chair is like a county chair. I've been to 3 Democratic conventions, the last 3 as a delegate. We have representation at the national headquarters in Washington. And I've become very active in that. I became an educator. I have a high school's principal's license. I've served as a chairman of a department, as an assistant principal for a short time in Israel as a principal, although I don't like administration in Israel. I just finished as a classroom teacher after 35 years. I have my own newspaper, English newspaper, local paper in Rehovot today. I'm very active with our city hall as a volunteer. I've been a playwright.
You've had a busy, full life.
Yeah, and I hope I'm not through yet.
No question about that. Well, my final question to you is the same question I ask everybody, and I think the answer is sort of obvious, but I'll ask it to you anyway. I mean, are you glad that your parents made this decision to come to America?
Absolutely. I have no doubt about it. If they hadn't, there for the grace of God, I would be exterminated along with the 6 million, no doubt about it. Another fair question of me is, and I'll give you a definitive answer on that, are you glad you emigrated and left America and went to Israel? And that is, while it's definitive, I would say yes. It requires an explanation. The answer has to be yes, because I have no opportunity to do it any other way. When I came to Israel, I had a year where I took a leave of absence, and I could have come back. But we burned our bridges, and it's humanly impossible for me. It's not true of case in every case. There are many people who come to Israel and went back. In my case, it's just not possible. The Israeli government is not as generous as the American government, and I cannot take with me or can get my pension from Israel in America as I can get an American pension in Israel. I'm a dual citizen, and I take my citizenship, my American citizenship, very seriously. When people ask me, this is different from most of my colleagues, I say I'm an American living in Israel. German-born American living in Israel. Most of those people like myself who have come from America and moved to Israel and have been there permanently will say, I am a former American, I'm an Israeli. I don't look at it that way. I am first and foremost and always and last an American. I'm thoroughly ingrained. I have vested interests in this country. I have great love for this country. I know this country saved my life. I am proud of being a Jew, and I live in Israel. I'm not completely in concert with what's going on in Israel, politically or otherwise, but I've learned to live with it and deal with it. And I found a niche in Israel. I was a little fish in a big pond here, and I am a big fish in a little pond there. And for the rest of my days, I do not want to live anywhere but in Israel, hoping to come and visit America as often as I can. I have, at this particular moment, my children and my grandchild here, in addition to other close relatives, many friends, many fond memories. And I hope America will hear from me in a not too distant future. I still have high hopes of peddling my play. My play has not been produced. While the subject matter of the play is very traumatic, what happened to it after it was completed is equally traumatic. I've had it sold 3 times, and yet in the last minute before it was staged, something unusual happened and it was not staged. I'm hoping that in the near future it will be staged. I have not given up hope. I know that the children of Israel wandered in the desert for 40 years. Menachem Begin waited to become Prime Minister of Israel for 29 years. I'm only in my 13th year since I've written it. So I keep plugging.
Well, we certainly wish you, you know, a lot of luck with that. And I want to thank you for having Brian and I out here. And
I want to thank you for listening to me and coming out here. And I hope that whatever little I said, or a lot I said, will have some use to your work and to the people who will hear what I had to say.
I'm sure it will. Thank you.
I do want to say that, in closing, that people who come to these shores, if you really stick your nose to the grindstone and keep plugging, there is room for everyone in this country, and it certainly is a land of opportunity.
Indeed. Thank you very much. This is Paul Seeger signing off for the National Park Service.